Let me invite you this morning to open your Bibles to the book of Esther. The book of Esther. We welcome every visitor that is here this morning, and we have a number, and we're so glad to see you. Glad you're able to be here. We want you to be at home in these assemblies. This is a continuing series of great women of the Bible. You don't have to struggle to find them. It does not take any pressing of the case in some untoward way to find these enormous figures who made contribution to the purposes of God and have become an example for us, both men and women, I might say. Great characters, not just great women, but great characters. As I said before, it may seem strange that a man would be unfolding these things. But as I argued before, I believe men know sometimes in a special way what women bring, because it is our emptiness that you fill. And we are especially conscious, or ought to be, of those qualities that are uniquely yours, that are God-given, that without which the world would be deeply impoverished, that we celebrate. We celebrate the wonder of the woman as God has created her, and we despair of modern feminism, which is absolutely a hatred of what is feminine, a despising of what is uniquely womanly, and an effort to escape from it rather than to fulfill it. We studied last Sunday the quiet, pastoral scenes of the book of Ruth. The story of a young Gentile girl who married a Jewish boy and who came to be a devoted, earnest follower of Jehovah. Today we study about a young Jewish girl who becomes the wife of a great Oriental potentate. Both these young ladies don't seem to have aspired to anything great. Ruth would not have been seen as someone significant or important in the little town of Bethlehem. But she did what she needed to do, and in her daily domestic tasks, fulfilled her purpose of becoming the great-grandmother of David and an ancestress of the Son of God himself. What she did was significant, although it didn't look at the time to be significant. And so the lesson was obvious, it seemed to me, that women in their daily tasks need to realize that they are making contributions for eternity, that there's nothing small nor ordinary about the things that many think of as mundane and insignificant. But this is another setting. No pastoral scenes here. This is the court of an Oriental despot, the king of Persia, where these events are worked out. All kinds of ungodly intrigues are involved. Things that a young Jewish girl would have had no knowledge of, would have been in many ways ill prepared to meet. It is as the book of Ruth fits into the period of the judges and comes after the book of Judges. It is a description of events that took place during the period of the Restoration. The events described in Ezra and Nehemiah, and then at the end of this historical section of the Old Testament, we have the book of Esther. This concludes the historical framework. Everything else that comes after Esther must be fitted in to the history that's already been told. It's a narrative of events that took place during the time when the Jews had returned already to Jerusalem. By the time this story occurs, the temple has been rebuilt. Cyrus was an ancestor, I suppose, at least royally speaking, if not by bloodline, of this king. This king Ahasuerus, who is mentioned in the book of Esther, or Xerxes, as we probably would know him in Persian history, is the fourth king after Cyrus. And it had been in the time of Cyrus that God had invited his people by means of this Persian king to come back to Jerusalem. Cyrus had made possible the return of the Jews after 70 years of captivity since the time of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian invasion of Jerusalem. A lot of things have happened since then. While this story is unfolding, those Jews still struggle in the city of Jerusalem. The walls are still burnt. The walls are still broken down. And this story will end before those walls will have been rebuilt in the time of Nehemiah. It's a story of how the whole Jewish nation, not just that part that was involved with Persia, the immediate vicinity of the capital of Persia, Shushan or Susa, but the salvation of, the preservation of the whole nation. And the reason that's significant is because it's the preservation of the line of the Redeemer. Because without this people and without those who came through this people, we would not have redemption in Christ. I am confident that this young Jewish maiden had no idea that she would play such a role. She was an orphan and was reared by her older cousin, Mordecai. The book of Esther is not filled with great doctrinal discourses. In fact, they're totally absent. The name of God, remarkably, is not even mentioned. But I think those who study the book would say that God is more powerfully present here implicitly than even explicitly in some other books of the Bible. He is in the shadows behind all these events, and we all know it. Let's begin by reading the initial verses of the first chapter. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus who reigned from India even to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast to all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. I want, before we unfold this story that's told in Esther, to get some sense of just exactly who this Ahasuerus was, this Xerxes. His father was Darius the Great. Darius had determined that India and Egypt and Babylonia and Media and Assyria and Asia Minor and the northern part of Greece was not enough. He wanted to enlarge his empire. He chased the Scythian cavalrymen who had come down to disturb his empire all the way up into Russia in order to try to stop their ravages on his empire, and then decided that it was about the time that he ought to take Greece. And so he sent his armies into Greece. And he met them at Marathon on the coast. You've heard about Marathon. It was Darius the Great, the father of Ahasuerus, who fought the battle at Marathon. And he thought he had absolutely every advantage and there wouldn't be any difficulty in defeating him. In fact, that's what the Athenians thought, when with their few men compared to the Persian army, which gathered troops from all over the empire and all sorts of nationalities, they met at Marathon and they sent word to the city of Sparta that they needed help. And that's the origin of the running of the marathon, because a man in 2 days ran 100 miles. And by the time the Spartans got there, the Athenians had already mopped up on the Persians and Darius had had to take his troops and go home. It was an insult that his son, Xerxes, did not forget. This is the king who took an army, Herodotus says, of about 2 million. Well, actually, Herodotus says it's nearly 3 million, but everybody thinks that Herodotus, being a Greek, might have been exaggerating the size of the opposition. 2 million men, or thereabout. And he assembled 1,200 ships as a navy. And he built a bridge across the Hellespont, that body of water that divides modern Turkey from modern Greece. And he built it by arranging ships side by side all the way across, and then tying them together by rope that was tightened up by capstans on either side. Then they put planks down across this causeway, and then they put brush, and then they put soil, and then they built up a wall on either side of it so that the animals wouldn't be frightened, and they drove them across, this army, nearly 2 million men. This was an enormous undertaking. And I have to say that Xerxes, Ahasuerus, was not a little impressed with what he was achieving, and he had all these ships out in the harbor as the men passed by. And there wasn't a thought in his mind that ever anybody could defeat him, as it's in his army there. He ruled all the way from India to Egypt. And now he thought it's time that he had Greece, the one exception to the power of Persia. And they got down to Thermopylae. And a fellow named Leonidas with 300 men stood in that narrow little gap and held off the Persians for days. They all died, these Spartans. But it slowed down the Persian army until when they got down finally and they were able to burn Athens. They thought still to conquer Greece, but the naval battle at Salamis was the end of everything. When a navy the fourth the size of the Persian fleet defeated the Persian navy, and they all went home in disarray, and Xerxes had to pick up his toys and go home. That's the king. This is the man who becomes the husband of Esther. He's not a good man. He was a man capable of great cruelty. It's obvious, even as this story unfolds, that he could act with almost heedless haste to see the slaughter of thousands of people that doesn't even know, hasn't even investigated, find out whether or not they deserve slaughter. And then he can turn around and arrange another slaughter. But Esther is caught up in these events, and she's the center of our study. But before we get to her, I want us to look at another remarkable woman who was a Gentile. She was the queen of Persia. She's the queen of the world. Vashti. I don't know whether this was the occasion. I doubt that it was when Ahasuerus brought all his counselors together to prepare for his war against Greece. It would have been about this time. That battle took place in 480 B.C. And this is the third year of the king's reign. He began to reign in 486 B.C. But he wants all his ministers to view the glory of his kingdom. And so he has a 6-month-long festival in Shushan. And it is opulent. In all the magnificences of his empire on display, he wants everybody to be impressed. And when that 6 months is passed, he has a 7-day eating and drinking bout for everybody. And when that 7 days is nearly to its conclusion, and the king's heart is merry with wine, the scripture said, and everybody else, no doubt, is in his cups. I mean, 7 days of eating and drinking is likely to put you in that mood. He says, let's have the queen come in. Beautiful. She's beautiful, he said. You'll all enjoy looking at her. We're going to have her come in and be on display here. Well, you can imagine the nature of the setting. Vashti has been entertaining the wives of these men. And when word comes by the king's messenger that she is to come into his chambers to be viewed by all his minions, she sends back the simple message, I will not come. Now there is all kind of possibility in that. You've got to understand that what she did was put her life on the line. You may be thinking about the fact she's risking the throne of Persia, which is exactly correct. What this woman thinks about herself, she may be a pagan. She may be a Gentile coming out of backgrounds that are not promising. But this is a woman who has some sense
of respect for herself, and she is not about to make a display of herself before a group of drunken bums. And she'll risk the throne for that. So she says, I'm not coming.
You can imagine the disturbance that took place in the chambers of Ahasuerus when the servant comes back, whispers in his ear, she said she's not coming.
The king of the world has said, you come here and be here. And the one who got the message from the king of the world said, I'm not coming.
Now, there are some people who will interpret this scene as being manifestations of early feminism, that the wives all got together over there in their side of the house and said, we're not going to do this. Let's just put a stop to this nonsense. We've had enough of this already. But that's not the case. That's a misreading of this text, absolutely.
She had greater respect for herself than to make a spectacle of herself before these drunken men. And so she refused to participate. She risked her life. Let me tell you about this fellow, Xerxes. On one occasion, a father of five sons, four of whom had fought in the Persian army. Everybody from 15 to 50 was expected to serve in the Persian army. Came and asked Xerxes if he wouldn't give special dispensation to that fifth son, that he wouldn't have to fight. To which this great king responded by taking that boy and cut him in half and put half the body on one side of the road and half on the other side of the road as the army passed. These were bloody men. And they rule with absolute power. And if you're going to say no to a man like this, you better get ready for the consequences. She said, I don't care. Let him do what he will. She thought more of herself than she did of the kingdom of the world. We're called upon to do the same thing often. I want to say to women in this audience, if the societal pressures of these days, the obvious immodesty, call upon you to make a display of yourself before a group of stupid men, then you're going to have to make a decision, aren't you? What do you think of yourself? How do you view yourself? Are you just one of the mindless bimbos who runs about in this world following whatever fashionable statement may be currently made by the couturiers? Do you see yourself in this world as just fitting into the program? Whatever heedless individuals want you to do. We're back at school again, aren't we, young people? And the pressures are there. Everybody's in school again. They couldn't wait. I was listening to a program recently on television, watching a program that talking about the schools in Chicago, which haven't started yet. And one young man was deeply angered by the failure of school to start because he hadn't gotten to wear his new shoes. I've forgotten what brand, but he hadn't gotten to wear those shoes. And so everybody's in school now making their fashion statement. And if you don't fit the mold, they're going to think you're a bit strange, and you're going to feel the pressure of that, and they're going to be calling you to come and share in what is the standard that's been set by the latest fashion thrust. What are you going to do about that? And they're going to tell the same old smutty stories that a lot of school children love to tell. What are you going to do about that? They're going to do a lot of things that are calculated to diminish the human spirit and to make us not men but animals. And when the call comes, as it certainly will come from these peer pressures, you're going to have to decide what you think about yourself, who you are. Who are you? Are you nothing more than a little ape, a little mimic, who just responds every time your chain is jerked? To walk in those directions, Vashti said, I am not doing it. And I don't care what the consequences are. Perhaps this is one of those people who, about whom Paul writes in the second chapter of Romans, verse 14, who not being under the law, yet did by nature the things of the law, who understood something of these high principles that come from God. A principle that says what you are inside, who you are, is absolutely vital. And you need to pay attention to it. I'll tell you this much. Some women have traded a great deal more for a great deal less than this woman did. A lot of young ladies have been willing to trade their self-respect by taking off their usual amount of clothing and opening themselves up to the gaze of a group of idiots. But I want to say this. There are some people whose acceptance is not worth having. And being faced with this kind of idiocy, don't you yield to it, whatever it costs. You're more important than that. You're more significant than that. You have a greater value than that. Well, it's interesting to me that Vashti, who acts, it seems to me, with great courage, is sort of moved off the stage. She is demoted. I'm not sure how far, whether she just becomes one of the concubines, thrust aside. She is no longer the queen. My impression is that Xerxes was not a monogamist. One of his servants is spoken of as the one who kept the concubines. And so she's out. Vashti is out. If that's the way it is, we've got to get rid of her. His male counselors say, if this gets out, all of us are in trouble. We can't allow this. These were little men. This is not what God had in mind when he said the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ the head of the church. These were despotic little men whose whole idea of leadership was rule of the most austere and selfish sort. And it is to be rejected by every man who is a child of God. It is to be rejected. It is to be rejected for the model of Jesus Christ, who emptied himself for the sake of those he led, and whose leadership was always for the benefit of the beloved. And so must we be. We must lead and guide and nurture always for the benefit of the beloved and never for ourselves. Never for ourselves. Well, this situation, the loss of the Queen of Persia, opens up the need for another queen, because the king grows lonely. 4 years later, the decision is made to find a replacement. And so his minions are sent out across the empire to find all the beautiful virgins who may be brought in for his inspection. This is a sort of a cattle run. I think there's nothing about this that should be commended. I mean, this is a beauty contest. There's not one indication that Ahasuerus had any concern about the character of these women. Very shallow, superficial, just exactly as he demonstrated himself to be in the first chapter. So in the second chapter, efforts made to find someone. Now we find out about Mordecai, who had reared his uncle's daughter after her parents died. And she was very beautiful. And so far as Ahasuerus was concerned, that was the major consideration. She was very beautiful. And she is brought with other maidens and prepared by the king's eunuchs. I did read one note that said that out of Greece, every year, at least 500
young boys who were, as we say, unsexed, were brought in to care for the harems of Oriental rulers. That's not a very pretty picture. But that's who these eunuchs are here, taking care of business. Supposedly past being influenced by the wrong kind of motives in order to care for those women who are the property of the king. So Esther comes to the household of Ahasuerus, and she finds favor in the mind of Haggai, who is the keeper of the women, verse 8 of chapter 2. And then finally, when she's brought before Ahasuerus, she finds favor in his eyes. And in fact, she is selected to be the queen. She's going to be the one. And so she's elevated to the queen of the world. I don't think that Esther had this in mind. By the way, her name was not Esther. It was Hadassah. And that means myrtle. I don't read about too many young ladies being named Myrtle today. Used to be a common name. Esther means star. I've wondered as I read this story if perhaps that wasn't a name that was given her after she was elevated. Maybe they didn't want Queen Myrtle anymore. That didn't have a ring about it. But Hadassah was her Jewish name. It was an honorable name. And then she is named Esther. And she is the queen of the world now. And about this time, we got another character come on the scene. His name is Haman. He is an ambitious, unscrupulous, vicious, cruel, selfish individual. And his interest is wholly in how he can get on top of things. And the king, who may have recognized Haman's qualities because he had some of the same, elevated him to be the prime minister. Gave him a seat above all the princes. And of course that thrilled Haman's soul. And then when he walked out of the king's gate, of course everybody praising him, everybody throwing adulation his way. He walks out of the king's gate, everybody's putting his forehead on the ground as he comes out. But there's one lonely silhouette there. Reminds me of those three Hebrew boys when King Nebuchadnezzar said, when the music sounds, I want everybody's face on the ground before my God. And those three boys wouldn't bow. Mordecai would not bow to Haman. It might be our suspicion that the reason for it is because he knows what a rascal Haman is. And he's not giving this kind of adulation to a rascal. And so he refuses to bow. My impression is because later on he reveals who he is. He has revealed who he is. He's told Esther, don't tell anybody that you're a Jewish. But on this occasion we find out that Mordecai said openly to those who came to him and asked him why he was disobeying the king's order to bow before Haman, he tells them he is a Jew. And the only reason I can think of that Mordecai would say that is because he felt that the honor being asked for this man was divine in nature, that he was being asked to worship this man. And he wasn't about to do it. And so he refuses. You say, well, didn't he think about the consequence? What this can bring upon not only his own adopted daughter, but upon the whole of his people, doesn't he calculate what the consequence of this is going to be for other people? I suspect he did. But he understood one thing, that you don't ever bless anybody else by disobeying the will of God. And so he just did what was right. Do you think you and I have any higher calling than that? Than to do what is right as he comes to us? The consequence of this is that he stirred up what was really bestial in Haman, his pride. He wasn't tolerating this for a moment. In fact, he said, it'd be too small a thing just to get at this one stubborn Jew. What we got to do here is destroy all of them. Remind you of Herod the Great. Going to get rid of all the babes of Bethlehem just to
somehow get his hands on Jesus. And so he's going to kill all the Jews in the whole Persian Empire just because of the affront that one has offered him. Now, there's some of us like this. You embarrass us. You humiliate us in any way, and we're going to take care of you. And it won't make any difference how many people have to get hurt to do that. We're going to do that. Is there any of that in us? He was a vicious, unprincipled man.